Welcome back and good morning once again, everybody. This is Mark Steiner right here on The Mark Steiner Show and your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We begin our program this morning talking about, continue our conversations about the recent Supreme Court decisions. There are more coming up today that we'll be waiting to hear what those results are. We're here joined today by Jossie Ross, writer, father, attorney, artist, member of the Blackfoot Tribe, and author of How to Say I Love You in Indian. Jossie, welcome back. Thanks for getting up so early.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Always good to have you on the air with us. And Ellie Mistel is with us. Ellie Mistel is the legal editor for More Perfect, Radiolab's new spinoff podcast about the Supreme Court. She writes for the site Above the Law and has appeared on SNBC, Fox News, among many other places. And Ellie, welcome to the show for the first time. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
And y'all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here by email, talk@steinershow.org. Tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. But first, Jossie, let me begin with asking you about General Corporation v. Mississippi Band of Choctaw Indians, which was a really interesting case because there's been this continuing battle, maybe you can outline for us, over the decades around sovereignty on Native land.
Yeah, and it was a really unfortunate case, honestly. It's ugly because it involved, sexual abuse of a child. And that was the grounds upon which Dollar General, unfortunately, chose to fight the jurisdiction that they reasonably entered into by consent with the Mississippi Band of Choctaw Indians. And, it was a very good conclusion, both procedurally and substantively, because this young man now, he's aged out, he's not a child anymore, but hopefully he does substantively, as the case returns to tribal court, gives some sense of satisfaction that this corporation is going to be held accountable as they signed up to do.
So give us an underlying sense before I turn to hit a couple of the cases here about this overall issue. I mean, the Native nations have been battling for sovereignty, the right to try people, the right to handle legal affairs, whether it involves somebody who is a member of the reservation of that nation, or whether it's somebody on the outside who's committed a crime on the nation's land. So, I mean, this is an issue that has tentacles. It's a much larger piece.
Yeah, it's actually the crux of Native nationhood, and tribes generally. I can't speak and say absolutely, but generally hire very competent legal counsel and try to do things the right way. And so the issue here, for the listeners who don't know, was that a corporation, the Dollar General Corporation, they entered into a contract to put one of their stores on the Mississippi Band Choctaw Indian land. And they said, with full expectations and informed consent, that yes, if there is a dispute, we will do this in tribal court. And then lo and behold, when there were a dispute arose based around sexual abuse, one of the Dollar General employees sexually abused a child or allegedly sexually abused a child, the Dollar General Corporation said, no, we do not want to enter that contract. So it's not only the basis of federal Indian law and us trying to make sure that our inherent sovereignty, our ability to protect our homeland and protect our citizens, is fully recognized, but it's also just a matter of honor that you do what you say as a corporation, enter into a business and a contractual relationship with any entity, much less a nation.
So, and I just want to jump in here. I think I have this right here. We just saw coming across the news line, Ellie, that the Supreme Court just killed the Texas anti-abortion law. What just happened here?
Yeah, so this is a huge victory for abortion rights advocates. The Supreme Court, by a vote of 5-3, which is somewhat surprising, decided that Texas's abortion restrictions were too restrictive and therefore unconstitutional. The vote was 5-3, and the conservative justice who flipped was Anthony Kennedy. Anthony Kennedy also had the controlling vote in the affirmative action case. Just trying to process this in real time, I got to say the first thing that occurs to me is that Anthony Kennedy is way more concerned about his legacy than anybody anticipated. he does not want to be known as the guy who killed affirmative action, and apparently he doesn't want to be known as the guy who killed abortion. Last term, he wanted to be known as the guy who granted gay rights to millions of people. So Kennedy is really playing the is playing for the history books at this point, I think.
But he still loves but he still loves the police.
He still loves the police, and he still thinks that that Texas can do what it wants to immigrants.
But, this is really interesting. This is I think, you know, Josh, this whole case that just came down moments ago is huge in turn because of the whittling away of the rights of women to choose. States making it very difficult.
I haven't seen any of the discussion within the case at all, or know the basis for the decision. But I mean, yeah, this is a huge decision, and it is interesting given Kennedy's history. That's all I could say. 5-3 is absolutely incredible in 2016.
Kennedy is a strong and proud Catholic. He has voted in the past for some of the more some restrictions on abortion at the Supreme Court level. So this was a surprise. But again, I think that, and look, the abortion challenge, the anti-abortion forces had a tough case to make here. And as I'm kind of skimming through the decision, the key issue seems to be that the court ruled that the only purpose of this Texas restriction was to restrict abortion, right? It wasn't for, I mean, the case is called Whole Woman's Health, right? And the court is kind of saying that this was not about women's health, right? You can imagine an abortion restriction more kind of closely tailored to the promotion of women's health that Kennedy would absolutely support. But here, it seems like Kennedy, and Kennedy didn't even have the majority opinion here, but it seems like the majority of the court felt like this was an abortion restriction by all but named means.
So who are the three who voted in dissent?
Not to say Scalia. Scalia, I'm sure, would have voted.
I'm sure he would have, yes.
Thomas wrote the main dissent, I believe, and Chief Justice John Roberts and Sam Alito all dissented. The majority opinion is written by Stephen Breyer, and there's a concurring opinion by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, which is not at all surprising, joined by Kagan, Sotomayor, and Anthony Kennedy, shockingly.
So this is really interesting to watch how this is breaking down, especially now as we're approaching this presidential election and see that the next president of the United States of America, whoever that might be, Secretary Clinton or Mr. Trump, will get to choose the next one or two people on the court, which is huge.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's particularly funny, right, is that, as I'm sure most of your listeners know, the Republicans have not held even a hearing on Obama's nominee, Merrick Garland, who, by acclamation, is a centrist prosecutor. This is not a firebrand liberal. I think what's going to be funny, funny if you have a sick sense of humor like I do, is that if Hillary wins, I anticipate that the Republicans will try to quickly confirm Merrick Garland because he is probably more centrist than anybody they'll get from Hillary. And if that happens, I expect Obama to pull Garland back and say, well, you know, I'm a lame duck now. And then we can watch Republicans' heads explode.
Jossie, go ahead. What were you about to say?
No, that makes complete sense. I appreciate that analysis. It's interesting because I think that there's enough people like myself who otherwise have a particular I was a Bernie Sanders supporter, as you know, Mark, and I really would probably check out of the process at this point because I'm that much not enthralled with Hillary Clinton. And I think there's a lot of folks empirically there's that movement going around. There's that energy. However, the reality that these are some old ass people. And they're, you know, that they will be probably very likely, just chronologically, as a matter of fact, be replacing two justices. That will get people like me who are not enthralled with our prospects right now to vote because, there has to be some level of accountability and some wise placement of justices onto this court for the next 30 years.
So there's another case that if anything breaks by the time we have this, we'll let you know about other cases coming up. But that was really, I think, a really important one because if that had gone through, that would have really led to a tumbling in Mississippi, Georgia, other places of deep restrictions against women's access to abortion. But there's also the undocumented workers piece, which I think is Texas v. U.S.
Yep.
That just happened, Jossie. I think that is huge because it puts all these hundreds of thousands from I don't know the exact number. You probably do, Ellie, 800,000 to some millions of younger undocumented people who came with their parents and others from being able to work and be safe. So that was a huge decision.
Yeah, and it could potentially split families, but you know, I think it's important for people to remember that the court wasn't trying to make a decision about what U.S. immigration policy should be. The court was trying to make a decision on the extent of executive power, and this is one of the fun
right.
things I think of one of the reasons why I love reporting on the Supreme Court. It's the kind of case that doesn't actually necessarily break down liberal conservative. Yes, the justices kind of broke down 4-4 liberal conservative. It looks like a big gridlock decision. But you can get a lot of liberals who are worried about the extent of executive power that Obama showed, and you can get a lot of conservatives who think that the executive should be just as powerful as Obama thinks they are. So while this kind of came to head on this particular issue, and this issue is a hot button, you know, public media issue, the actual kind of legal wrangling here is much more about, you know, the limits of executive constitutional power, and more so than some of these political decisions. This is kind of what we want the court to be doing, right? We want the court to be arbitrating which branch should be in control. I think at Obama's press conference, there was a telling moment where Obama said, look, I think we've pushed executive power to its limits. You know, he's done all he can constitutionally as the president. It is now obviously, I think, time for Congress to act on the issue. And all the court said, well, really, the court didn't say anything because of the split. But all they really did was kind of affirm Texas's belief that this issue, this immigration issue, this deportation issue, needs to be solved by Congress.
Jossie?
Yeah, you know, I mean, exactly that, you know, they really didn't say anything because, first of all, it was a tie. But number two, it was a one-sentence ruling, so I believe it was one sentence. So it wasn't as if there was a whole lot of analysis, and I think that this was one of those, you know, in basketball they would call it a heat check, you know, where Obama, you know, I believe Obama wanted to test the parameters of what his executive authority was, and we kind of saw what it was.
That's exactly right. It's a total heat check. That's perfect.
That's good. I mean, that's what we get, Joshua, you get when you have a Columbia law grad who's also a basketball player.
That's right.
Watch that back to that. So, but another case here I want to talk about is the affirmative action case. Again,
yeah.
I think this is really significant. And let me just jump in here again. Ellie, I know that you are, and more perfect, tell our guests, our listeners a little bit about a more perfect, and this is your episode coming up, which is a brand new podcast I want to let folks know about.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, so More Perfect is a spinoff of Radiolab. It's really focused on the Supreme Court, but not in the kind of, you know, jargony law school way of doing it. We're really trying to explain, you know, the third branch of government to people who, you know, sometimes don't know exactly how the court works or why it works in the way it does. And so I think that the affirmative action case, the next episode we have coming up, I think it drops today, is about plaintiffs and about how cases come to the court. And the Fisher case, the affirmative action case, is a perfect lens to look through because in the aftermath of Fisher, there's been a lot of, you know, online hate kind of directed at Abigail Fisher for trying to overturn affirmative action and all this kind of stuff. And look, I've said some unkind things about Fisher myself, but the episode really focuses on the fact that Fisher is just, she's just the, you know, the figurehead on this case. There are lawyers or would-be lawyers kind of behind the scenes that are really responsible for these kinds of cases coming up to the court. And in the Fisher case, it's a man named Ed Bloom, who has been wildly successful at getting conservative conservative kind of anti-civil rights cases up in front of the Supreme Court, possibly for overturning. So he was involved in Fisher. He was involved in Shelby County, which is the voting rights case that Roberts, where Roberts gutted the voting rights case. And
right.
So our next episode really focuses on how you go about kind of getting cases in front of the Supreme Court. It's fascinating.
So, and Jossie, this affirmative action piece, how do you see this?
Well, you know, if I agree with, is it Ellie? I apologize.
Ellie, yes.
I agree with Ellie in the macro picture, but there has to be someone, there has to be those figureheads. And yeah, to a degree, Fisher is simply a symbol, because if it's not her, it's going to be somebody else. But if I had to characterize this, I watched this terrible show where they do like kind of the Darwin Awards. People just do really, really stupid, self-defeating things. And as a matter of empirical fact, white women are the largest beneficiaries of affirmative action. So if I see white women specifically trying to gut affirmative action, I think, well, this is a nominee for the Darwin Awards. This is stupid. You're doing something that will specifically harm other folks that are similarly situated to you. And you know, it's unfortunate, because there's so much misinformation out there. So these attorneys who bring these cases absolutely have a vested interest in misinforming about the empirical data that says that, number one, that white women are the largest beneficiaries, and number two, that this particular program, specifically at University of Texas Austin, was in no way offensive toward, really, you know, there was, as a matter of fact, a lot of folks who qualified ahead of her. And so it wasn't this particular, I guess you can say, you know, it could have been this one particular, you know, black student mathematically, but there was a whole bunch of white students. And so it reeks of a special kind of jurisprudential racism, where we can say, yeah, we can attribute it to these black folks or these people of color, but if you wanted to, you can also attribute it to a whole bunch of white folks. So there's sort of a little bit of you know, selling a story, selling a narrative, because it's very convenient there.
Hey, man, I've said, look, I agree with you, but I've said, look, Abigail Fisher was a mediocre student, and one can expect mediocre students to make mediocre decisions about what lawsuits they attach their name to.
Tough crowd here.
Like, you know, if she had been a better student, not only would she have gotten into Texas, but she certainly would have realized everything you just said. So I think it's instructive, and again, to kind of bring it to the public, to look at, you know, who was behind Abigail Fisher. The attorney Ed Bloom that I was talking about, I mean, he's friends of her father. You know, so this is a student who, you know, if you've ever not gotten, if you've ever not gotten into a college or a school that you wanted to get into, I'm sure you're hurt, I'm sure you're angry, and they kind of took this person and this young person in that situation and put her out there because she's, you know, a white girl who looks like the girl next door.
So, folks, do join us, 410-319-8888. Didn't mean to leave you out of this. We're talking about Supreme Court decisions here with Jossie Ross and Ellie Mistel. Mistel or Mistel? How do you say it?
Mistel rhymes with Kristal.
Gotcha. My producer told me that and it completely went out of my head. Mistel. Ellie Mistel. 410-319-8888. You can write to us here, talk@steinershow.org, by email. 410-319-8888. Tweet us at Mark Steiner and join in on this conversation with our two guests about these recent Supreme Court decisions. So this when you look at this court right now with this potentially four to four ties, I mean, we talked about this a moment ago, but I'm going to come back to it for a moment. Josh, let me start with you this time. Just the kind of the real kind of debate over the importance of the Supreme Court, the importance of who gets to choose who sits on the Supreme Court. I was looking at decisions that took place in 1966 that upheld the Fourth Amendment when it came to stopping, especially black folks in cities. But now we have the opposite coming in the case that just happened in 2016. Some 50 years later. So, I mean, talk a bit about your perspective on that.
Well, yeah, it's hugely important. And in fact, it's, you know, as I mentioned briefly earlier, a large enough decision that it probably will mobilize and hopefully will mobilize people to otherwise who aren't interested in this particular election and might think, I don't want to put words in their mouth, but these are two pretty mediocre candidates. To mobilize them to actually vote, because it is that significant. And obviously with you know, Brother Antonin Scalia's, you know, dearly departed, you know, departure a little while ago, it becomes even more significant. And that's why we see these ties, we see these 4-4s, and, you know, a lot of going back to the trial courts for additional findings. And so it is something that, you know, it's not a abstract question anymore, you know, whether or not, because we kept on waiting for these white folks to die to say, well, you know, there's going to be an opportunity. And there would, you know, for a long time, there were no appointments. It seemed like they were just living forever. They were taking some really, really good stuff. But now it seems like that mortality has been sweeping in, and it's a really real thing at this particular moment. It's acute and in the moment, and, you know, it will have an effect in this particular upcoming election.
But historically speaking, young people have not been keyed in or tuned in to the Supreme Court. Historically speaking, they haven't voted based on what kind of justice system they want. Now, maybe that will change in this election, and I think that when you if you can talk about the justice system in general, and you look at, you know, that goes beyond just what happens at the Supreme Court. That goes all the way down to, you know, are you voting for your local district attorney? Maybe because of all of the media in the past, you know, 4 to 6 years, maybe young people will get clued in and keyed in and excited and motivated to understand that voting for a president, voting for Congress, voting for your senator is a vote for your justice system as well. But historically, I'm wrong. Like, historically, that just hasn't happened. So I still worry that, you know, that this key issue will be a key issue when it comes to electoral politics.
I think there's a space, and if I can just reply.
No, please, go ahead. Please do.
I think, you know, as a matter of empirical data, that's absolutely true. But I think, given a few things, number one, Bernie Sanders, the excitement that he's been able to create where people actually understand that Citizens United is the real thing. And number two, the culture wars, specifically around same-sex marriage, specifically around abortion rights. I think that those can generate enough, I think, this is speculation, but that it can generate some excitement where there's those talking points, those big picture questions culturally, that will influence the next 30 years of what young folks are going to live through, where it might incite them to participate.
I hope you're right. I hope you're right. And I hope the message just gets through to the Senate, because that's the other issue here, right? Like the Senate's obstruction of Merrick Garland is, you know, top line news. But what's less discussed is how the Senate generally obstructs judicial appointments to the lower circuit courts, kind of throughout the judicial appointment system, how many open judge spots, judicial spots we have in our system because of congressional obstruction. So somehow, not only do people need to vote kind of for the titular heads of these organizations, but they also have to be able to put pressure on their senators to act and let them know that, you know, confirming justices is part of their job. And I don't see anything for that. You know, I don't see, you know, McConnell has his heels so dug in on this issue. I don't know what electoral pressure you can really put on the senators to get them to take their job seriously.
No, and I think that's why there's a larger political question here, of course, what happens to the U.S. Senate in this race as well. That we can do that for another day, though. But I think this is what we're seeing unfolding here. And I think that these cases really say to me so much about the kind of split, not just in America, but really our different interpretations of what America means vis-a-vis our Constitution and the law. I mean, that to me speaks volumes to how people react to the decisions that were just made.
Yeah, I mean, it gets really into the heart of some cultural issues. And here's another kind of interesting kind of backstory to what's really going on in the court. You know, there's still, I think, in this country, an open question as to whether or not the court should be involved in this at all, or whether or not really it should be done state by state, voter by voter at the ballot box. We see in lots of situations, you know, take civil rights. You know, the civil rights movement is almost impossible without the Supreme Court, because you could never get electoral majorities in the South to overturn, you know, segregation and some of the legacies of segregation. So the Supreme Court, and then we talk about this in More Perfect, the Supreme Court kind of becomes the last bastion of minority rights, not just minorities in terms of ethnic or racial minorities, but minorities in terms of just people who can't win elections. And what we're seeing now, kind of recently, is this rhetoric or this thought process being applied to the conservative side. If you look at, again, let's go back to affirmative action. You couldn't overturn affirmative action at the ballot box on a national level, but you can overturn it kind of state by state, minority by minority, in certain counties and whatever, and that's one of the efforts that's underway. You couldn't overturn abortion on a national ballot level, right? But you can kind of chip away at it. Not today, but usually you can kind of chip away at it in state by state, and you can chip away at it at the Supreme Court. So one of the questions one of the fundamental issues where the court finds itself at the center is to what extent they're going to defend minorities from the tyranny of the majority, versus to what extent they're duty bound to kind of go along with what people say in the voting booth.
So, Jossie, I think it does go to the heart of it's, whether we're talking about, it seems to me, from the notion of Brexit to what's happening in this country here and around the globe, there's so much of this kind of bring it home local, which used to be a real power thing, even among the civil rights folks in the early 60s and SNCC and SDS and more, but especially in SNCC, of local control. But local control often now means, and local votes like that often now mean that that communities of color and poor people get no voice and are just walked on.
Yeah, that's kind of by design. You know, you see that with the Voting Rights Act cases, the redlining, et cetera, et cetera. There's a conscious effort. It's by design. You well know. And so, you know, there needs to be that place. I'm originally from the Black Indian Reservation, Valley Mountain. Also from the Suquamish Indian Reservation. And Native nations are, by definition, we like decentralized government. We like the ability to govern ourselves. That's what that particular case, you know, Dollar General was about. And, okay, well, we're going to enter into contracts as fully sentient agency-having entities. But at some point, because of those disparities in power, and oftentimes disparities in finances, you do need a place to be able to get satisfaction if the local authorities aren't doing their job, and that has become the role of the Supreme Court, certainly during civil rights times, but definitely now as well, for any time a smaller group, or undervalued, overlooked group, regardless of whether it's a racial minority or it's a LGBTQ, or you simply can't put that in the hands of the populace, because the populace in that particular place isn't going to, unfortunately, see things on an even scale oftentimes. And so there does need to be that place where we can find satisfaction on a somewhat more, a neutral, objective level. And that has become the role of the Supreme Court.
The two of you have been great together. This has been a great conversation, and I want to appreciate the time you both took for us. You just heard Jossie Ross, who is a writer, father, attorney, activist, and artist, who has written two incredibly interesting books, Don't Know Much About Indians and How to Say I Love You in Indian, and Ellie Mistel, who is a legal editor for More Perfect, Radio Lab's new spinoff podcast about the Supreme Court, which we will be linking to on our website, and looking forward to hearing that and doing more with them and with him as this thing unfolds. And so Ellie and Jossie, both, thank you both so much for joining us here for the first part of the Mark Steiner Show this half hour.
Thank you so much for having us.
And good luck on the podcast, Ellie.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we look at Brexit. What does it mean for all of us? Stay with us.